Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Ilana Levine.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. Here's Ilana and friends with some revelations. Little known fact of the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Hey everyone, new episodes of Little Known Facts drop every Monday and you can find them on your favorite podcast provider. Also, if you go to the website, littleknownfactspodcast.com, you'll find behind the scenes photos, videos, and interviews and lots more on the gallery page. And if you are loving these intimate, candid conversations with all the artists who come on the show, please head over to the contributions page. I depend on these donations to continue to bring you these interviews every week. So if you love the show, please donate. Little known fact about my guest today, he doesn't read reviews because good or bad, they just don't help him. Welcome, Tony Shalhoub.
A-OK. A-OK.
My guest today is the Golden Globe, Screen Actors Guild, Emmy, and Grammy Award-winning actor, Tony Shalhoub. He made culinary film history with Big Night and has a long list of illustrious film credits that include Longtime Companion, Barton Fink, Honeymoon in Vegas, Searching for Bobby Fischer, IQ, Men in Black, A Civil Action, Galaxy Quest, Primary Colors, Spy Kids, Made Up, and Pain and Gain. He has appeared in over 30 television shows, but highlights include the sitcom Wings, the award-winning performance as the title character in Monk, Too Big to Fail, Nurse Jackie, and Brain Dead. A graduate of the Yale School of Drama, he's been nominated for the Tony Award at least 3 times. His Broadway plays include The Odd Couple, The Heidi Chronicles, Conversations with My Father, Lend Me a Tenor, Golden Boy, and Act One. He recently completed The Band's Visit to critical acclaim and is soon to return to Broadway in The Price. He has lent his voice to many animated films, books, and video games. He directs, he produces, he's married to the beautiful actress Brooke Adams. He is a mad, passionate fan of the Green Bay Packers. And I want to welcome Tony Shalhoub to the podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great to be here.
This is amazing. Now, I'm married to someone who I believe had a cheesehead on when I met him. And this is how much I love him, because I still married him. So think just that image.
He didn't wear it to the wedding.
He wore it down the aisle in lieu of a yarmulke. just a little Green Bay yarmulke.
I think they make cheesehead yarmulkes, too.
I really hope so.
Wait a minute. Is Dominic from Wisconsin?
Dominic is from Madison.
I guess I didn't know that.
Yes. My husband and Tony both crossed paths on Nurse Jackie.
Right.
And there are so many similarities when I look at your story and his story. My husband is the 9th of 10 children.
No.
I kid you not. His father grew up working for Oscar Mayer, which is a meat organization, although your father...
My father was sort of an independent businessman.
That's right. Contractor.
Amazing.
You both grew up in the Midwest. His father was of Italian descent. Your father was Lebanese, but both immigrants in a culture, white culture.
Right. And we both wore cheeseheads at our wedding.
In lieu of yarmulkes.
Phenomenal.
It is. You actually are Dominic Famuso. This is very strange for me.
I didn't know that about him.
I know, but his passion for the Green Bay Packers has backfired a little bit because, look, we don't live in the Midwest, so our children don't have the same, they have conflicts of interest in their own schoolyards. However, we have started to send him out of the house to watch the games because he gets to... Local.
Animated.
Are you an animated or are you a more internal nail biter?
I am very animated when the game is on. There's much screaming and stomping of my feet and throwing things at the set.
Right. Like it's your team. Like you're on the team or you're coaching the team.
Well, I feel that they need me to be that animated.
Are you superstitious?
I wouldn't say it's superstition. I say it's more science-based.
If you were home watching the game and your team was winning and someone walked in the room and suddenly they fumbled or there was an interception or something bad happened, would you blame the person who came in the room?
I wouldn't admit to doing that. I wouldn't say it out loud.
But it's
but
not
I
beneath
might,
you.
I might think the thought.
All right. Well, let's go back a little bit in time to growing up in Green Bay,
okay.
which is the home base of this team that means so much to all of us. What was it like in your household? You were the 9th of 10.
That's right. The youngest boy. And it was bedlam. It was a close-knit, and still is actually, a close-knit family.
Is it true that he came here at 10 years old as an orphan? Is that your,
well,
is
yeah.
that true,
he was actually,
your father's story?
He was actually 8. He came with his siblings. His parents had died in Lebanon, and this was 1920.
Did they speak English?
No, they did not.
Was there a family in the U.S.? Is that what brought them here?
Yes. There were relatives that had already migrated here, and they were sent for. But the children lived there after the parents had died, lived there for 2 or 3 years with just the help of an uncle or various neighbors or friends. It was really difficult.
Yeah.
They made it over, you know. Went left Beirut, came through Marseille, came to New York, Ellis Island. Why they all ended up in Wisconsin, I can't answer that. They couldn't answer that.
And your mom was also of Lebanese descent.
That's right.
But born in America.
That's right.
So how did they meet?
They met. Now we're getting into the weeds.
Okay.
They were kind of related.
Okay.
Let's just say that.
Is that part of why you're a genius?
No, that's by why there's. It explains a lot about
okay.
my.
Everything.
My neuroses.
Okay.
She remembers when they all got off the train, I think, and she told us the story. She saw, you know, she was only probably 2 years older than him, and they got off the train, and she thought to herself, you know, thank you, God, for sending Joe for me to marry.
At 12 or yeah. 10 or however old
she was. She was 10
and
he was 8.
Cut so she to, was like a mystic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Cut to, you know, a couple decades later, and sure enough, there they were. And then the babies started coming.
Yes, that's okay. fantastic. And coincidentally, I also saw, and you can correct me if this is true, but is it in fact true that your wife, Brooke Adams, is a descendant of John Adams?
According to my wife, that is true.
That is true.
And
that is absolutely true.
No one has come forward to dispute it.
Okay.
So I'm going to go with that story.
Yes. Don't you think who we are from? It's impactful.
I think it is. And you know, people always ask me questions about
Monk.
Becoming an actor or my process
yeah.
or whatever that means. And I always feel that being one of the youngest, you don't have as much of a voice.
Mm-hmm.
You become more of an observer, I think. At least that was true in my case. And I always feel like I am not only my process, but my entire personality really is kind of a product of all of these other, all of my siblings. I draw from them, and I feel that they kind of, in a way, molded me for good or for ill. And I take great comfort in that, and I'm very grateful for that too. I always feel like when I'm doing a part, when I'm on the stage, I'm kind of carrying all of that with me.
Obviously, at some point, somewhere along the line, whether it was a teacher, a sibling, the arts came into your life. Can you talk about the beginning of your realizing that you were going to be an actor?
One of my older sisters was in high school. They were doing an operetta there. They were doing King and I.
Uh-huh.
And I guess they must have asked the girls at it was an all-girls school.
If they had any kids, bring
we need kids. Bring your
right.
brothers and sisters. So that was the story. I wasn't exactly, you know, asked. I was just kind of
recruited.
Yeah, you could yeah. kidnapped. I
yeah,
think
you
the
were
word.
Actually.
I was abducted, but then there I was. I just found myself there, and I was 6 probably, and I know maybe that's where the hook was
mm-hmm.
set. So I'm grateful to her that she dragged me to that.
That she kidnapped you, that she put you in the trunk of the car.
She is still a wonderful actress. She's still acting. She, in fact, she's on the Netflix show, Stranger Things.
That's amazing.
She's having an amazing time.
That's amazing.
She does a lot of theater. She lives in Atlanta. She's doing good. And you know, there's others, a couple of others of us who kind of keep our hand in it too.
Right.
But even more than going and doing that play, I think there was just growing up in that, and I think your husband would vouch for this, that there's a certain kind of pressure almost to perform. You have a kind of a built-in audience, of course. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of performance going on in our household.
Right.
You know, just people trying to make each other laugh and entertain each other, and or maybe just even to get a little
attention.
A tiny bit of attention.
Yeah, forget. Please. I know there's no milk left, but maybe I can make you laugh.
My mother's, you know, like passed out on the couch and she's still exhausted.
Yes, because she's been pregnant for 20 years straight. Absolutely.
I'm not getting, you know, a lot of action there.
No.
So we were kind of like a, it was a little bit of a three-ring circus.
So you weren't shy as a kid.
Well, you really couldn't be shy because you were sort of prompted and coaxed to, you know, like, what do you got?
Number nine?
Yeah. Who can you imitate? And, you know, that kind of thing.
When I saw Barton Fink, I don't know how early on in your career that was. Was that one of your earlier movies?
Oh, yeah. It was, I think, my second or third movie.
Did you audition for that?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember?
I remember it very well. I went in to meet Joel and Ethan Coen, and I had seen Blood Simple. That was their first movie
that
I was aware of. And I was so knocked out. It was so unlike anything I'd ever seen. And then when I read Barton Fink, I really felt like, I love this period of time. First of all, that 1940s.
Oh, yeah.
Just
so much fun.
Feel like I can kind of fit into
that.
So I did read for them. I know that I read for them here in New York. I lived in New York then. And then they told me, or they told my representatives, that they were going out to Los Angeles after seeing a lot of people for various roles here. They were going out to LA to read people there. That's good. That's fine. So weeks passed, 3, maybe even 4 weeks passed before I, you know, got word that I was going to be able to do it.
Listen, I don't know what the hell you said to Lipnick, but the son of a bitch likes you. You understand that, Fink? He likes you. He's taken an interest. Never make Lipnick like you. Never!
I don't understand.
Death? He likes you. He's taken an interest. What the hell did you say to him?
I didn't say anything.
Well, he's taken an interest. That means he'll make your life hell, which I could care less about. But since I drew the short straw to supervise this turkey, he's going to be all over me too.
You make huge choices in that scene. How were you so confident so early on to be so brave? And it's brilliant. Were you scared to do that? Or were you like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go for it.
I was a little anxious about it going into the audition. I knew that John Turturro was going to be playing that part. And I think he was already cast. And I think John Goodman was already cast. And, you know, John Turturro, we didn't overlap at Yale, but he was there right after me. And I knew John from his theater work, too. And I figured, okay, well, they've cast John, and John is, you know, he's a certain size and kind of strange inventiveness to him. And I thought, I think I'm gonna just sort of like go for that. And if it's too big, they can tone me down. They didn't really tone me down.
It's fantastic.
They gave me a lot of rope. And I was a big fan growing up of all those movies from the 40s, you know.
Like John Garfield and
His Girl
sort
Friday
of,
and those, you know, those sort of fast-talking
Cary Grant,
Rosalind Russell. Since this movie is sort of in that, takes place in that same time period, and I thought, you know, that sort of fast, that patter is so kind of appropriate to the period. Not a lot of psychology. They weren't really worried about psychology. They were just spinning the words out. They did it so skillfully that you never missed a syllable, even though they were overlapping and, you know.
So the accent for Big Night came from where? Because now that's the accent people listen to if they have to go into an audition and have an Italian accent.
Oh, I hope not.
They listen to you. Everyone's doing it.
Oh, God. that's interesting story. I was doing Wings at the time, and I'd known Stanley, and Stanley and I had done a play, and you know, years before that. And Stanley said, "I want you to do this part, and you know, we're going to speak with accents. We're going to speak some Italian in the movie, so we're going to work with the dialect coach." And I said, "Well, yeah, you know, I've been playing Antonio Scarpacci for years now on Wings." So he just looked at me very seriously and said, "Not that accent."
That's so, an award-winning show that has made me very popular. Well, thank you.
No.
Was that improvised, that film, or was that pretty?
No, they were pretty tightly scripted.
Did you have an idea at the time that you were making it that this was really special?
I felt that it was special for all of us. You never know how a movie is going to translate, you know, to the general population. But we also believed in it and what it was really about. You know, this idea of trying to balance art and commerce. It was something that all of us as younger actors were struggling with. You know, how much do I do for art's sake, and how do I not live like a starving artist? And what kind of jobs do I want to do for money? And how do you do that balance?
Right. How do you negotiate that?
Very tricky. But more than that, it was, you know, about, you know, this family, these immigrants. And so I related to that. It was centered around food. I certainly related to that as a Lebanese American. I have brothers, very close to my brothers, close but not without conflict,
right,
too. So all of that was inside of it. So we were emotionally, you know, and personally invested in these characters and in this story. Stanley, more so, I think, because it was a story that involved Italians that didn't have to do with the mafia.
Right.
Example, because he had been, you know, he was confronted as an actor with, you know, auditions with just those kinds of roles after having done one or two of them. And he saw the writing on the wall.
So when you got out of Yale, you went to ART Theater in Boston. Was that your first job out of school?
Oh, yes. American Repertory Theater.
And is that where you met Brooke?
No, I didn't meet Brooke until 10 years later. I was doing a play on Broadway.
The Heidi Chronicles.
That's right. And I was doing it. Well, I was with the first replacement cast, and I was doing it with Christine Lottie. She was playing Heidi. David Hyde Pierce was in that.
Great cast.
And Christine left after 4 months to do a film. She had an out to do a movie, and I had a couple more months in the play. And Brooke was her replacement. She came out from L.A., and that's how we met.
Right away.
Yeah, we actually didn't get together right away, but that was the beginning of my life took a hard right turn then. So I'm very grateful to Wendy Wasserstein for writing that play, to Christine Lottie for taking that
for
movie.
For leaving.
For taking that movie.
Yes.
Win-win.
Yep.
And then I met my wife. And my wife had already adopted a child as a single woman.
Wow.
Which is interesting because in the play, in Heidi Chronicles, that's what Heidi does at the end of the play. She adopts a child as a single woman. And Brooke had already done that.
So how old was Josie and Sophie? Is your other daughter, how old was she when you and Brooke got together?
She was 2.
Okay, teeny tiny.
2.5.
Teeny tiny.
And 3.5 when we got married. And then after we were married a year, so we adopted Sophie.
Now they're grown up.
Now my oldest daughter's engaged and is going to get married in the fall.
Oh my God. I hope he wears a cheesehead yarmulke down the aisle.
No question.
I'm sure of it. So did you ever not work?
Oh, sure. Oh, yes.
Can you remember that day? Because it feels pretty fluid.
No. There were a lot of stretches of time. And you always feel like, well, this is it. I'm done now. It's over and I'm never going to.
You still feel that way?
Well, sure. I think you could ask any actor that. And this is part of the, you know, the landscape that you have to kind of to navigate. You know, and the thing I tell people is that idea that it's a roller coaster. That's really, really true. The trick, what I've kind of come to is that you have to not lose sight of that fact, and that when you're on the rise, or when you're on the top of the roller coaster, it kind of feels like, oh well, I'm at the top now and I've arrived, and so it's just clear sailing from here on out. And you you can't, you have to remember that it's a roller coaster.
Right. It is going to go down really fast.
It's not going to stay up there.
Right.
And then it's going to go down. And then when you're at the bottom of the roller coaster, you feel the same way. You feel like, all right, I'm at the bottom. It's finished. And then you lose heart. So the idea is you have to remember, it's a roller coaster. It's going to, you know, and if you're just going to keep your, you know, nose to the grindstone, you know, you don't lose sight of that fact, you're going to be on the rise again. But just not to feel that those extremes are permanent states.
So when you were doing Wings, which was a breakout role for you in terms of being on a long lasting series and being on a show for many years, you didn't have the pressure of carrying the show. You had this great part. The show was the show.
Not only did I not have the pressure of carrying the show, I came into the show probably a year and a half into it.
Right. The train had left the station.
It was up and running. The machine was, you know, firing on all cylinders. And I was very fortunate. I did one episode. I was brought on to do one episode. And they liked my character, and so they made me a regular. But when I first was on it, it was just a one-off.
You were going to guest star on the show called Wings. That's incredible. That never happens.
It never happens.
But it happened for you. Were you always lucky? Were you a lucky kid? Do you feel lucky?
I feel incredibly lucky. I don't remember being lucky as a kid.
You're like, I'm lucky I got in the bathroom today before school started.
I felt very fortunate, I mean, in terms of, you know, Brooke coming into my life and I've had challenges in my life where, you know, I was, you know, physically I was not in great shape, and I came out of those times. And in my career, certain things fell a certain way. Yes, a lot of luck, I would say.
When did Monk happen after Wings?
Well, Wings ended in 96 or 7, as I remember, 97. And Monk came along in like 2000, 2001, maybe.
So
that lasted 8 seasons.
Right, which is extraordinary.
Well, I did a series in between those. I did something called Stargraving Mad, which was only lasted one season with Neil Patrick Harris.
I remember that.
It was on NBC.
Right.
And it was a terrific time. It was Steve Levitan was the craziest guy who did Modern Family, of course, one of the guys. And we had a blast doing Stargraving Mad.
So that was disappointing when it didn't continue.
Oh, I'm still not over it.
I'm so sorry.
I'm still,
well, know, I do have some Tate's time. Cookies for you to take home. I'm sure that'll make you feel better. I'm sure of it.
I'm cured.
Cookies solve everything, Tony. So then Monk comes along, and that sort of changes everything.
Yeah, Monk was for a lot of reasons. It was an interesting, challenging part, but also it was the first time that I was a producer on a show, and so I had some input. I had a voice in terms of story and in terms of, you know, I was in the editing room and I was involved in casting, guest casting. USA Network at the time was really going through a transition. They were kind of reinventing themselves. They didn't have a lot of original series. I think it was just us and The Dead Zone, and that was it. They nurtured us. They really took care of us because there wasn't a lot of product.
Right.
And they were trying to compete with the other cable networks. And so it was, again, luck enters into it. The timing was it was just right. That script had been sitting around for years, first at ABC and then at USA, and it was just languishing there.
And did you feel your life change in terms of how recognized you were?
I mean, I definitely felt a shift. I think maybe it was harder for my kids because they maybe found it more difficult to share me and, you know, my time and so forth. But I tried not to let it overtake my life. I mean, I worked with some very, very big movie stars over the years where I really saw that, you know, their lives were hugely impacted. I was often recognized, but for the, you know, the wrong person.
Who did they think you were?
There'd be people like, oh, you're the guy from Seinfeld. What? There's a bald guy, there's Michael Richards, and there's Seinfeld.
I'm not one bit the guy from Seinfeld.
Or then people would say, oh, I know you. What's your name? And then I'd tell them my name, and they go, no, not that guy.
Tell us what you've done.
I say, well, you wouldn't really know it. And then they say, yeah, yeah, what have you done? And then I tell them, and they go, no, I don't know that.
Nope.
So now people say, oh, you're an actor. And I sort of, you know, okay, sure. Well, who are you again? I can't remember. And I say, George Clooney.
You're about to start a play. Do you get nerves around a play?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I do. And I think that's a good thing.
Do you have stage fright or any kind of...
I haven't had that, but there's still time. I wouldn't call it stage fright, but you know, you get twisted up and you get anxious and you always worry that, you know, this time you're not going to be able to kind of find that groove. And theater is a tricky kind of a animal because there's never any, again, there's never, you're never really arriving. It's always a process. It's mm-hmm. always changing. You're never really doing it the same way. The audience responds to it. There's so many factors. Your energy is different from day to day. Your level of preoccupation or distraction with some other thing that's happening in your world. It's, you know, there's so many different aspects that make it fluid and elusive.
Do you read reviews?
No.
Did you ever?
I did early on, and they drove me insane, and that's why I don't now. I got a lot of bad reviews in the early going, but even on the rare occasion when I would get a favorable review, I discovered that it just didn't help me. It really didn't. There's no real profit in it, I think, for an actor. It's not really, doesn't have anything to do with what we do. It's maybe for, if I was a producer, maybe I would, you know, be interested in, oh, is the box office going to change?
Right.
When I did read reviews, and I still read reviews of
other things. People.
Oh, sure. Sure. Whether it's film or television. Not a lot, but occasionally.
Right.
But what I discovered was that I've never experienced a time when, you know, there's always, for the same thing, the same play or the same movie or whatever it is, there's always a good review and a and some bad reviews.
Yeah.
They never agree. And what's the point?
I know for me, the bad review is right.
Well,
I can absolutely.
Sure.
Because I walk in believing that that's what it's going to be, and it only helps solidify my already.
Those critics are, you know, they come and go. I'm still here until somebody stops hiring me or until somebody says, stop doing this now. I'm just going to keep going. And I've just seen a lot of them. I don't know. Where are they? I don't know. They come, they go.
They're in the critic graveyard.
They're not part of my process. And I'm more, especially nowadays with the internet, people write their own reviews a lot of times.
You've been working for decades. Did you ever have a time where you didn't get work?
People like say, oh, you never stop. And I do. I mean, there are a lot of times where I feel like I'm just idle. I'm just, my engine is just, you know, when is the next thing going to come along?
Right.
I don't know.
Can you think back to a story in your life, an audition story that haunts you to this day? Can you choose one?
In fact, there are very few actually good normal audition
good.
Stories, to be honest.
Good. That's heartening.
Yes.
It's heartening for the rest of us.
There are so many. I mean, I could write a book on my awful auditions. One interesting one was that I just arrived in New York. I'd been up in Boston working for 4 seasons, and I just came to New York. I had just come, and one of my very first auditions in the city was for The Female Odd Couple. And I went in and read for the producers, I think, and the director. And then I had a call back, and I think maybe the director was there the second time. Anyway, the second callback was for Neil Simon. But Neil Simon at that time somehow had thrown his back out.
Aww.
Don't know the story, but he was laid up. I had to go to his hotel room to audition for him because he was, you know, propped up on the bed. I mean, it sounds like a weird casting couch story, but it wasn't that. But so I went to this hotel. I think it was the Sherry Netherland or some fancy hotel. And there, I walk into this room with the casting director, casting person, and sure enough, there's Neil Simon. And it wasn't like a big room. It was just like...
This is his hotel room.
There wasn't a whole lot of room in there. I was standing at the foot of his bed. And he had this kind of like... expression on his face. It was pleasant, but I could tell that he wasn't moving. And I had to do this scene for a man in bed. And then I got the part. And then I remember when we opened the show, finally, he wrote me his opening night card. And he said, you should always audition, in hotel rooms, because it was really effective.
Because there you were. Was that your Broadway debut?
Oh, my God. It was yes. My stock went way up in my dad's eyes. I'm not sure he thought, what's this guy doing?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure.
And all of a sudden, I was legitimate.
Yeah. That's all it took. Well, you're pretty legitimate at this point. I hope you can, if I give you nothing else today, because you've been on the Little
Now that I've done your show, I really feel
legitimate. Don't you feel good? Tony, thank you so much for coming today and being so generous with your time and your life.
My
really
pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Can I have a cookie now?
Are you kidding? You can have a whole bag. If you want more information about my guests, go to the website littleknownfactspodcast.com. I also wanted to tell you that there is now a new addition to the website. It is a button that says contributions. This podcast is a true labor of love, and I really, really want to keep doing it for a long time. So if you like listening as much as I love to do it, please feel free to contribute. It would mean the world to me. Also, on Twitter, you can find me at Alana Levine. Instagram is Little Known Facts Podcast, and on Facebook, Little Known Facts Podcast. You can also feel free to rate and review the show on the iTunes show page. This podcast is recorded at Hanger Studios in New York City. This episode was brought to you by Pro Media. Located in Times Square, Pro Media offers both production and post-production services out of its beautiful studios in the heart of New York City. Pro Media, sound vision. Find out more at promedia.nyc.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.